was one of these acute episodes. You might see seizures, vomiting, lethargy, hypoglycemia, coma, the doctor says. In about 20% of cases, the infant can die. Kennedy walks toward the jury box and turns so that her back is facing them, so that she is watching the witness with them. Doctor, if Davis Bauer had MCADD, and if no one at the hospital knew it, and if the medical protocol was to have him fast 3 hours prior to his circumcision like any other infant without the disorder, and if an acute metabolic episode occurred in his little body, isn't there a chance Davis Bauer would be dead even if Ruth Jefferson had performed every conceivable medical intervention? The medical examiner looks at me, his gray eyes soft with apology. Yes, he admits. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. The energy in court has changed. The gallery is so quiet I can hear the rustle of clothing, the murmur of possibility. Turk and Brittany Bauer are still gone, and in their absence, hope blooms. Howard, beside me, breathes a single word. Damn. Nothing further, Your Honor, Kennedy says. And she walks back to the defense table, winking at me. I told you so. My confidence is short-lived. I'd like to redirect, Odette says, and she gets up before Dr. Binney can be dismissed. Doctor, let's say that this abnormal result had come into the nursery in a timely fashion. What would have happened? There are some abnormal results that require a letter to be sent to the parents in due course, suggesting genetic counseling, the medical examiner says. But this one, it's a red flag, one any neonatologist would consider emergent. The baby would be monitored closely and tested to confirm the diagnosis. Sometimes we send the family to a metabolic treatment center. Isn't it true, doctor, that many children with MCADD are not formally diagnosed for weeks or months? Yes, he says. It depends on how quickly we can get the parents in for a confirmation. A confirmation, she repeats. Then an abnormal result on the newborn screening is not a final diagnosis. No. Did Davis Bauer ever come in for more testing? No, Dr. Binney says. He didn't have the chance. So you cannot say, beyond a reasonable medical doubt, that Davis Bauer had MCADD. He hesitates. No. And you cannot say, beyond a reasonable medical doubt, that Davis Bauer died of a metabolic disorder. Not entirely. And in fact, the defendant and her legal team might be grasping at straws to try to throw some shade in another direction. Any direction that doesn't point to Ruth Jefferson intentionally harming an innocent newborn, first by withholding treatment, and then by reacting so forcefully she left bruises on his tiny body. Objection! Kennedy roars. I'll withdraw, Odette says, but the damage is done, because the last words that jury has heard may as well be bullets shooting my optimism out of the sky. That night, Edison is silent on the way home. He tells me he has a headache, and almost as soon as we have walked in the door and I am starting supper, he comes back through the living room with his coat on and tells me he's going out to clear his head. I don't stop him. How can I? How can I say anything that will erase whatever he's been through? Sitting behind me every day so far like a shadow. Listening to someone try to make me into someone he never believed I could be. I eat by myself, but really, I just pick at the food. I cover the rest with tinfoil and sit at the kitchen table waiting for Edison. I tell myself I will eat when he returns. But an hour passes. Two. When it's after midnight and he does not come back and will not answer my texts, I put my head down on the pillow of my arms. I find myself thinking about the kangaroo suite at the hospital. It's a room with an unofficial name that has a mural of the marsupial on the inside. It's where we put the mothers who have lost their babies. I have always hated that term. Lost, to be honest. Those mothers know just where their infants are. They would in fact do anything, give anything, even their own lives, to get them back. In the kangaroo suite, we let the parents spend time with an infant who has died for as long as they'd like. I'm sure Turk and Brittany Bauer were put in there with Davis. It's a corner room, next to the charge nurse's office, intentionally set aside from other labor and delivery rooms, as if grief is a communicable disease. This isolation means that the parents don't have to walk past all the other rooms with healthy babies and mothers in them. They don't have to hear the cries of newborns coming into the world when their own child has left it. In the kangaroo suite, we put the birthing mothers who knew, thanks to ultrasounds, that their babies would be born in a way that was incompatible with life, or the mothers who had to terminate late because of some gross anomaly, or the ones who delivered normally and who, to their great shock, lived both the greatest moment of their lives and the worst within hours of each other. If I was a nurse who was assigned to a patient whose baby died, I'd do handprints of the baby in plaster, or hair samples. I had professional photographers I could call, who knew how to take a picture of the deceased and touch it up so that it looked beautiful and vibrant and alive. I'd put together a memory box so that when the parents left the hospital, it was not empty-handed. The last patient I had who used the kangaroo suite was a woman named Zhao. Her husband was getting a master's degree at Yale, and she was an architect. For her entire pregnancy, she had too much amniotic fluid, and would come in weekly to have an amniocentesis to check the baby and to siphon off fluid. One night I took 4 liters of fluid off her, to give you a sense. And obviously that's not normal. That's not healthy. I asked her doctor what she thought it was. Was the baby missing an esophagus, possibly? A baby in utero normally ingests amniotic fluid, yet clearly if that much was accumulating, the baby wasn't swallowing it. But the ultrasounds were normal, and no one could convince Zhao that this was a problem. She was certain the baby was going to be fine. One day she came in, and the baby had high drops, a fluid collection under his skin. She stayed with us for a week, and then her doctor tried to induce, but the baby couldn't tolerate it. Zhao had a C-section. The baby had pulmonary hypoplasia. The lungs just didn't function. He died in her arms quickly after birth, puffy, swollen, as if he were jointed of marshmallows. Zhao was put in the kangaroo suite, and like many mothers who had come to terms with the fact that their babies had not survived, she was robotic, numb. But unlike other mothers, she did not cry, and she refused to see the baby. It was as if she had this image in her mind for a perfect little boy, and she could not reconcile anything less than that. Her husband tried to get her to hold the baby. Her mother tried to get her to hold the baby. The doctor tried to get her to hold the baby. Finally, when she was on her 8th hour of catatonia, I wrapped the baby in warm blankets and put a tiny hat on his head. I carried him back into Zhao's room. "Zhao," I said, "would you like to help me give him a bath?" Zhao didn't respond. I looked at her husband, her poor husband, who nodded, encouraging. I filled a basin with warm water and took a stack of wipes. Gently, at the foot of Zhao's bed, I unwrapped her baby. I dipped a cloth in warm water and ran it over the baby's sausage legs, his blue arms. I wiped his swollen face, his stiff fingers. Then I handed Zhao a damp cloth. I pressed it into her palm. I don't know if the water shocked her into awareness or if it was the baby, but with my hand guiding her, she washed every fold and curve of her baby. She wrapped him in the blanket. She held him to her breast. Finally, with a sob that sounded like she was tearing a piece of herself away, she offered the body of her child back to me. I managed to hold it together while I carried her baby out of the kangaroo suite, and then, as she collapsed in her husband's arms, I lost it. I just lost it. I sobbed over that baby the whole way to the morgue, and when I got there, I couldn't let him go any easier than his mother had. Now, the key turns in the lock, and Edison slips inside. His eyes are adjusting to the darkness. He is creeping because he expects me to be asleep. Instead, in a clear voice, I say his name from my spot at the kitchen table. "Why aren't you asleep?" he asks. "Why weren't you home?" I can see him clearly, a shadow among shadows. "I was alone. I was out walking." "For 6 hours?" I blurt. "Yes, for 6 hours," Edison challenges. "Why don't you just put a GPS chip on me if you don't trust me?" "I do trust you," I say carefully. "It's the rest of the world I'm not so sure about." I stand so that we are only inches apart. All mothers worry, but black mothers? We have to worry a little bit more. Even walking can be dangerous. Just being can be dangerous if you are in the wrong place at the wrong time. "I'm not stupid," Edison says. "I know that better than anyone. That's the problem. You are smart enough to make excuses for people who aren't. You give the benefit of the doubt when other people don't. That's what makes you you, and that's what makes you remarkable. But you need to start being more careful, because I may not be here much longer to..." My sentence snaps, unravels. "I may have to leave you." I see his Adam's apple jerk down, and then back, and I know what he has been thinking about all this time. I imagine him walking the streets of New Haven, trying to outdistance himself from the fact that this trial is coming to an end, and that when it does, everything will be different. "Mama," he says, his voice small, "what am I supposed to do?" For a moment, I try to decide how to sum up a life's worth of lessons in my response. Then I look at him, my eyes shining. "Thrive," I say. Edison wrenches away from me. A moment later, the door to his bedroom slams shut. Music whitewashes all the other sounds I try in vain to discern. I think I now know why it's called the Kangaroo Suite. It's because even when you no longer have a child, you carry him forever. It's the same when a parent is ripped away from the child, but the suite is the size of the world. At Mama's funeral, I put a handful of cold dirt from her grave in the pocket of my good wool coat. Some days I wear that coat inside the house just because. I sift through the soil, hold it tight in my fist. I wonder what Edison will keep of me.
Turk. I put my hands on both sides of Britt's face and touch my forehead to hers. "Breathe," I tell her. "Think of Vienna." Neither of us has ever been to Vienna, but Britt found an old picture in an antique shop once that she hung on the wall of our bedroom. It shows the fancy city hall building, the plaza in front of it filled with pedestrians and mothers towing children by the hand, all of them white. We always thought we could save up for a vacation there one day. When Britt was putting together a birthing plan, Vienna was one of the words I was supposed to use to help her focus. It doesn't escape me that I'm whispering the same word I used to calm her when she was delivering Davis, but now I'm repeating it to help her stop seeing the image of our dead son. Suddenly the door to the conference room opens and the prosecutor walks in. "That was a nice touch. The jury loves a mother who's acting so distraught that she can't control herself, but the threat in open court? Not the wisest move." Britt bristles. She pushes away from me and gets up in the lawyer's face. "I am not acting," she says, her voice dangerously soft. "And you don't get to tell me what's a good idea and what's not, bitch." I grasp her arm. "Baby, why don't you go wash up? I'll take care of this." Britt doesn't even blink, just keeps herself like a wall in front of Odette Lawton, like an alpha dog standing over another mutt until it has the good sense to cower. Then abruptly she walks away and slams the door behind her. I know it is already a big deal that Britt and I are allowed in the courtroom, even though we are going to testify. There was a hearing about it and everything before the trial began. That goddamn public defender thought she could keep us away by asking for all witnesses to be sequestered, but the judge said we deserved to be there because we were Davis's parents. I'm sure the prosecutor doesn't want to give him any good reason to rethink his decision.
"Mr. Bauer," the lawyer says, "you and I need to talk."
I fold my arms. Why don't you just do what you're supposed to do? Win this case.
It's a little hard when your wife is acting like an intimidating thug and not a grieving mother. She stares at me. I can't call her as a witness.
What?
I say.
But we did all that practicing.
Yes, but I don't trust Brittany, she says flatly.
Your wife is a wild card, and you do not put a wild card in the witness box.
The jury needs to hear from Davis's mother.
Not if I can't be certain she won't start screaming racist slurs at the defendant. She eyes me coolly. You and your wife may detest me and everyone who looks like me, Mr. Bauer, and frankly, I don't care. But I am the best chance, the only chance, you have to get justice for your son. So not only will I tell you what is a good idea and a bad idea, I will also be calling all the shots. And that means your wife is not testifying.
The judge and the jury will think something's off if she isn't a witness.
The judge and the jury will think she's distraught, and you will be a solid witness in your own right.
Does this mean that I love Davis less? Because my grief isn't enough to keep me from censoring myself, like Britt?
Yesterday, you heard the defense introduce the theory that your son had an undiagnosed metabolic disease?
It was when the pediatrician was on the stand. There was a lot of medical jargon I did not understand, but I got the gist of it.
Yeah, yeah, I get it, I say. It was a Hail Mary pass.
Not quite. While you were gone, the medical examiner verified the results. Davis screened positive for MCADD. I did my best to get the jury to discount his testimony, but the bottom line is the defense planted a seed that's already taken root. That your baby was tested for a potentially fatal disorder and the results arrived too late. And if none of that had happened, he might still be alive.
I feel my knees giving out, and I sit heavily on the tabletop. My baby boy was actually sick, and we didn't know? How could a hospital overlook that? It's so random, so pointless. The prosecutor touches my arm, and I can't help but I flinch.
Don't do it. Don't get lost in your own head. I'm telling you this so you can't be surprised during a cross-examination. But all Kennedy McQuarrie has done is find a possible diagnosis. It was never confirmed. Davis wasn't treated. She could have just as well said that your son would develop heart disease as an adult because that's what his genetic predisposition is. That doesn't mean it would ever happen.
I think of my grandfather. Dropping dead of a heart attack.
I am telling you this because when we go back in there, Odette says, I'm going to call you to the stand. And you're going to answer just the way we rehearsed in my office. All you need to remember is that there is no room for maybe in this trial. There is no this might have happened. It already did happen. Your son is dead.
I nod. There is a body, and someone has to pay.
Do you swear to tell the truth?
My hand flexes on the leather Bible. I don't read it a lot anymore, but swearing on it makes me remember Big Ike from back when I was in jail, and Twinkie. I think about him a lot, to be honest. I imagine he's out now, maybe eating the Chef Boyardee he craved. What would happen if I ran into him on the street? At a Starbucks? Would we do the man-hug thing? Or would we pretend we didn't know each other? He knew what I was on the outside, just like I knew what he was. But in jail, things were different, and what I'd been taught to believe didn't hold true. If we crossed paths now, would he still be Twinkie to me? Or would he just be another nigger? Britt is finally back in the courtroom. Anchored beside Francis. When she returned from the bathroom, her face still damp from wiping it with a towelette and her nose and cheeks pink. I said that I'd told the prosecutor no one tells my wife how to grieve, and that I couldn't bear the thought of Britt having another breakdown. So I told Odette Lawton there was no way she was putting my wife on the stand. I told Britt that I loved her, and it hurt me too much to see her hurting. She bought it.
Do you swear to tell the truth?
Mr. Bauer, the prosecutor asks, was this your first child with your wife, Brittany?
Sweat breaks out on my back. I can feel jurors staring at the swastika tattoo on my head. Even the ones who are pretending not to look are sneaking glances. I curl my hands around the base of the chair. The wood feels good, solid, a weapon. Yes, we were very excited.
Did you know it was going to be a boy?
No, I reply. We wanted it to be a surprise.
Were there any complications during the pregnancy?
My wife had gestational diabetes. The doctor told us that wasn't a big deal as long as she watched her diet. And she did. She wanted a healthy kid as much as me.
How about the delivery, Mr. Bauer? Was it a normal birth?
Everything went smoothly, I say. But then again, I wasn't doing the heavy lifting exactly. The ladies on the jury smile, just like the prosecutor said they would, if I made myself seem like any other father.
And where did you and your wife have the baby?
Mercy West Haven Hospital.
Did you get to hold your son, Davis, after he was born, Mr. Bauer?
Yeah, I say. When we rehearsed this in the prosecutor's office as if we were actors learning lines, she told me how effective it would be if I teared up. I said I couldn't cry on demand for fuck's sake, but now, thinking back on the moment Davis was born, I'm getting choked up. It's crazy, isn't it? That you can love a girl so much you can actually create another human being. It's like rubbing two sticks together and getting fire. All of a sudden, there's something alive and intense there that did not exist a minute before. I can remember Davis's feet kicking against me, his head in the palm of my hand. Those stormy, unfocused eyes puzzling me out. I've never felt that way in my life, I confess. I'm off script and I don't care. I thought it was a lie when people said they fell in love with a baby at first sight. But it's the truth. It was like I could see my whole future right there in his face.
Did you know any of the hospital staff prior to going to that particular hospital?
No. Britt's OB worked there, so it was sort of a done deal.
Did you have a good experience at this hospital, Mr. Bauer?
No, I say firmly. I did not.
Was it like that from the moment your wife was admitted?
No, that was fine. So was the labor and delivery.
The prosecutor walks toward the jury box. So when did things change?
When another nurse took over after the first one went off shift. And she was black.
The prosecutor clears her throat. Why was this an issue, Mr. Bauer?
Unconsciously, I reach up and rub the tattoo on my scalp. Because I believe in the superiority of the white race. Some of the jurors stare harder at me, curious. Some shake their heads. Others look into their laps.
So you're a white supremacist, the prosecutor says. You believe that black people, people like me, should be subordinate.
I'm not anti-black, I tell her. I'm pro-white.
You understand that many people in the world, in fact, many people here, might find your beliefs offensive.
But hospitals have to treat all patients, I say, even the ones whose ideas they might not like. If a school shooter gets injured when the cops try to take him out and he's brought to the ER, the doctors do surgery to save his life, even if he's killed a dozen other people. I know the way my wife and I live is not the way others choose to live. But the great thing about this country is that we all have a right to believe whatever we want.
What did you do when you found out there was a black nurse caring for your newborn son?
I made a request. I asked that she not touch my baby.
Is the African-American nurse you are referring to here today?
Yes. I point to Ruth Jefferson. I think maybe she shrinks back in her chair. I want to think that, anyway.
Who did you ask?
The prosecutor says. The head of the nurses, I reply. Marie Malone.
As a result of that conversation, what happened?
I don't know, but she got reassigned.
At some point, did the defendant interact with your son again?
I nod. Davis was being circumcised. It was supposed to be no big deal. They were going to take him to the nursery and bring him back as soon as it was done. But the next thing I know, all hell breaks loose. People were screaming, calling for help. Crash carts were being pushed down the hall. Everyone was running toward the nursery. My kid was in there, and I guess Britt and I knew. We got to the nursery, and there was a crowd of people huddled around my son. And that woman, she had her hands on my baby again. I swallow. She was hurting him. She was jackhammering on his chest so hard she was practically breaking him in half. Objection, the other lawyer says. The judge purses his lips.
I'll allow it.
How did you react, Mr. Bauer?
I didn't say anything. Britt and I, we were both shocked. I mean, they told us this procedure was nothing. We were supposed to go home that afternoon. It was like my brain couldn't process what was right before my eyes.
Then what happened?
The jury, I realize, is on the edge of their seats. Every face is turned toward me. The doctors and the nurses, they were moving so fast I couldn't tell whose hands were whose. Then the pediatrician came in, Dr. Atkins. She worked for a little bit on my son, and then she said there was nothing else to do. The words became three-dimensional, a movie I can't turn away from. The pediatrician looking at the clock, the way the others all stepped back, their hands in the air, like someone was pointing a gun at them. My son, too still. A sob belches out of me. I hold tight to the chair. If I let go, my fists will take over. I will find someone to punish. I look up, and for just 1 second, I let them all see how empty I am inside. She said my son was dead. Odette Lawton walks toward me with a box of Kleenex. She puts it on the railing between us, but I don't make a move to take a tissue. I am glad right now that Britt doesn't have to go through this. I don't want her to have to relive that moment.
What did you do next?
I couldn't let them stop. The words feel like glass on my tongue. If they weren't going to save him, I was. So I went to the trash and I pulled out the bag they were using to help Davis breathe. I tried to figure out how to attach it again. I wasn't going to quit on my own kid. I hear a sound, a high-pitched keen, one that I recognize from the weeks that Britt did not get out of bed, but shook our home with the force of her grieving. She is hunched over in her seat in the gallery, a human question mark, as if her whole body is asking why this happened to us.
Mr. Bauer, the prosecutor says gently, drawing my attention back. Some people here would call you a white supremacist, and would say that you were the one who started this ball rolling by requesting that an African-American nurse be removed from the care of your child. They might even blame you for your own misfortune. How would you respond?
I take a deep breath. All I was trying to do was give my baby the best chance in life he could possibly have. Does that make me a white supremacist? I ask. Or does that just make me a father? During the recess, Odette coaches me in the conference room.
Her job is to do whatever she can to make the jury hate you. A little bit of that is okay, because it shows the jury the nurse's motive. But just a little. Your job is to do whatever you can to make them see what they have in common with you, not what sets you apart. This is supposed to be a case about how much you loved your son. Don't screw it up by focusing on who you hate.
She leaves Britt and me alone for a few minutes before we are called back to the courtroom.
Her, Britt says, as soon as the door closes behind her. I hate her.
I turn to my wife. Do you think she's right? Do you think we brought this down on ourselves? I have been thinking about what Odette Lawton said. If I hadn't spoken out against the black nurse, would this have ended differently? Would she have tried to save Davis the minute she realized he wasn't breathing? Would she have treated him like any other critical patient instead of wanting to hurt me like I'd hurt her? My son would be 5 months old now. Would he be sitting up on his own? Would he smile when he saw me? I believe in God. I believe in a God who recognizes the work we are doing for him on this earth. But then why would he punish his warriors? Britt stands up, a look of disgust rippling her features.
When did you become such a pussy? She asks,
and then she turns away from me.
In the last few weeks of Britt's pregnancy, our neighbors, a pair of beaners from Guatemala who'd probably jumped a barbed wire fence to get into this country, got a new puppy. It was one of those little fluffy things that looks like an evil cotton ball with teeth and never stopped barking. Frida. That was the dog's name. And it used to come into our yard and shit on our lawn, and when it wasn't doing that, it was yipping. Every time Britt lay down to take a nap, that stupid mop head would start up again and wake her. She'd get pissed, and then I'd get pissed, and I'd stomp over and bang on the door and tell them if they didn't muzzle their goddamn animal, I would get rid of it. Then one day I came home from a drywall job to find the beaner digging a hole under an azalea bush, and his hysterical wife holding a shoebox in her arms. When I came into the house, Britt was sitting on the couch.
"Guess their dog died,"
she announced.
"So I see."
She reached behind her and held up a bottle of antifreeze.
"Tastes sweet, you know. Daddy told me to keep it away from our puppy when I was little."
I stared at her for a second.
"You poisoned Frida?"
Britt met my gaze with so much nerve that for a second I could only see Francis in her.
"I couldn't get any sleep," she said. "It was either our baby or that fucking dog."
Kennedy McQuarrie probably drinks pumpkin spice lattes. I bet she voted for Obama and donates after watching those commercials about sad dogs and believes the world would be a bright, shiny place if we all could just get along. She's exactly the kind of bleeding-heart liberal I can't stand. I keep this front and center in my head as she walks toward me.
"You heard Dr. Atkins testify that your son had a condition called MCADD, didn't you?"
"Well," I say, "I heard her say that he screened positive for it. The prosecutor has coached me on that one."
"Do you understand, Mr. Bauer, that a baby with undiagnosed MCADD whose blood sugar drops might go into respiratory failure?"
"Yes."
"And do you understand that a baby who goes into respiratory failure might go into cardiac failure?"
"Yes."
"And that same baby might die?"
I nod.
"Yeah." "Do you also understand, Mr. Bauer, that in none of those events would it make a difference whether or not a nurse attempted every medical intervention possible to save that baby's life? That the baby could still possibly die?"
"Possibly," I repeat.
"Do you realize that in that scenario, if your son was that baby, Mother Teresa herself could not have saved him?"
I fold my arms. "But that wasn't my son." She cocks her head.
"You heard the medical testimony from Dr. Atkins, which was corroborated by Dr. Binney. Your baby did indeed have MCADD, Mr. Bauer, isn't that true?"
"I don't know." I jerk my head toward Ruth Jefferson. "She killed him before he could get tested for sure."
"You really, truly believe that?" she asks. "In the face of scientific evidence?"
"I do," I grit out. Her eyes spark.
"You do?" she repeats. "Or you have to?"
"What?"
"You believe in God, Mr. Bauer, don't you?"
"Yes."
"And you believe things happen for a reason?"
"Yes."
"Mr. Bauer, do you use the Twitter handle @WhiteMite?
"Yeah," I say, but I have no idea what that has to do with her questions. They feel like a blast of wind that comes from a different direction every time. She enters a computer printout into evidence.
"Is this a post from your Twitter account made last July?"
I nod.
"Can you read it out loud?"
"We all get what's coming to us," I say.
"Then I guess your son got what was coming to him, right?"
My hands clench on the railing of the witness stand.
"What did you say?"
My voice is low, hot.
"I said your son must have gotten what he deserved," she repeats.
"My son was innocent. An Aryan warrior." She ignores my response.
"Come to think of it, I guess you got what you deserve too."
"Shut your mouth."
"That's why you're accusing an innocent woman of a death that was completely and utterly arbitrary, isn't it? Because if you believe instead what's really true, namely that your son carried a genetic disease..."
I stand up, fuming.
"Shut up!"
The prosecutor is yelling, and this bitch lawyer is yelling over her.
You can't accept the fact that your son's death was absolutely senseless and nothing more than bad luck. You have to blame Ruth Jefferson, because if you don't, then you're the one to blame, because you and your wife somehow created an Aryan child with a flaw in his DNA. Isn't that right, Mr. Bauer?
Out of the corner of my eye, I see Odette Lawton walk toward the judge, but I'm already out of my seat, leaning over the rail of the witness box. The monster that has been sleeping inside me is suddenly awake and breathing fire. You bitch, I say, going for Kennedy McQuarrie's throat. I am already halfway over the railing when some blockhead fake cop bailiff tackles me. You're a fucking race traitor! Distantly, I hear the judge banging a gavel, calling for the witness to be removed. I feel myself being dragged out of the courtroom, my shoes scuffing on the floor. I hear Britt calling my name and Francis's rally cry and the thunderous applause of the lonewolf.org posters. I don't remember much after that, except that I blinked, and suddenly I was no longer in the courtroom. I was in a cell somewhere, with cement block walls, and a cot, and a toilet. It feels like forever, but it is only a half hour before Odette Lawton shows up. I almost laugh when the deputy opens the cell door, and she is standing there. My savior is a black woman. Go figure. That? She says, was beyond foolish. There have been numerous times I've wanted to kill a defense attorney, but I've never actually tried. I didn't even touch her, I say with a scowl. The jury does not care. I have to tell you, Mr. Bauer, that your outburst in there undid any advantage the state might have had in this case. There's nothing else I can do. What do you mean? She looks at me. The prosecution rests. But I won't. Ever.
Kennedy. If I could turn cartwheels into Judge Thunder's office, I would. I leave Howard sitting with Ruth in a conference room. There is an excellent chance I can get this entire case tossed out. I've filed my motion for judgment of acquittal, and I can tell, as soon as I get into the judge's office, that Odette already knows she's sunk. Judge, I begin. We know this baby died, which is tragic, but there has been absolutely no evidence of any willful, wanton, or reckless conduct by Ruth Jefferson. The allegation of murder made by the state isn't supported, and as a matter of law, it must be dismissed. The judge turns to Odette.
Counselor, where is the evidence of premeditation? Of malice?
Odette dances around a response. I'd consider a public comment about sterilizing a baby a strong indicator. Your Honor, that was the bitter response of a woman who'd been subject to discrimination, I argue. It became uncomfortably relevant in light of later events, but it still doesn't point to a plan for murder.
I must agree with Ms. McQuarrie, Judge Thunder says. Spiteful, yes. Murderous? Not by the letter of the law. If attorneys were held accountable for the vindictive comments you make about judges after a case doesn't go your way, you'd all be charged with murder. Count one is dismissed. And Ms. McQuarrie, your motion on judgment of acquittal for murder is granted.
As I walk down the hallway toward the conference room to tell my client the excellent news, I check behind me to make sure the coast is clear. And then skip a little in my heels. I mean, it's not every day the tide of a murder trial turns in your direction. And it's certainly not every day that happens with your first murder trial. I let myself imagine how Harry will call me into his office, and in his gruff way, tell me I surprised him. I picture him letting me have my own share of the big cases from now on, and promoting Howard to cover my current duties. Beaming, I let myself into the conference room. Howard and Ruth turned to me, hopeful. He threw out the murder charge, I say, grinning.
Yes!
Howard pumps his fist in the air. Ruth is more cautious. I know this is good news, but how good? Excellent, I say. Negligent homicide is a whole different animal legally. The worst case scenario? A conviction carries almost no jail time, and honestly, Our medical evidence was so strong that I'd be shocked if the jury doesn't acquit. Ruth throws her arms around my neck. Thank you. Just think, I say, and by this weekend, this could all be over. I'll go into court tomorrow and say the defense rests, and if the jury comes back with a verdict as quickly as I think they will... Wait, Ruth interrupts. What? I step back. We've created reasonable doubt. That's all we have to do to win. But I haven't testified, Ruth says. I don't think you should get on the stand. Right now, things are going really well for us. If the last thing the jury has in their heads is that whack job Turk Bauer trying to come after me, you already have all their support. She stands very, very straight. You promised. I promised I would do my best to get you acquitted, and I have. Ruth shakes her head. You promised I could say my piece. But the beauty of this is that you don't have to, I point out. The jury hands back the verdict, and then you go get your job back. You get to pretend this never happened. Ruth's voice is soft but steel. You think I can pretend this never happened? She asks. I see this every day, everywhere I go. You think I'm going to just walk in and get my job back? You think I'm not always going to be that black nurse who caused trouble? Ruth, I say, incredulous. I'm 99% sure this jury is going to find you not guilty. What more could you possibly want? She tilts her head. You still have to ask. I know what she is talking about. Namely, everything I refused to talk about in court. What it is like to know that you are a target because of the color of your skin. What it means to work hard, to be an impeccable employee, and to have none of that make a difference in the face of prejudice. True, I had said she could have a moment to tell the jury her side of the story. But what's the point, if we've already given them a peg on which to hang their exoneration? Think of Edison, I say. I am thinking of my son, Ruth replies, heated. I'm thinking of what he'll make of a mother who didn't speak for herself. She narrows her eyes. I know how the law works, Kennedy. I know the state has the burden of proof. I also know that you have to put me on the stand if I ask you to. So I suppose the question is, are you going to do your job? Or are you going to be just one more white person who lied to me? I turn to Howard, who is watching our volley like we're the women's singles final at the U.S. Open. Howard, I say evenly, would you step out for a moment so I can speak to our client alone? He jerks his chin and slips outside. I turn on Ruth. What the hell? Now is not the time to stand on principle. You have to trust me on this. If you get on the stand and start talking about race, you'll erase the lead we currently have in the jury's favor. You'll be talking about issues that will alienate them and make them uncomfortable. Plus, the fact that you're upset and angry will come through loud and clear and negate any sympathy they have for you right now. I've already said everything the jury needs to hear. Except the truth, Ruth says. What are you talking about? I tried to resuscitate that baby. I told you I didn't touch him at first. I told everyone that. But I did. I feel sick to my stomach. Why didn't you tell me this before? At first I lied because I thought I was going to lose my job. Then I lied because I didn't know if I could trust you. And then, every time I tried to tell you the truth, I was so embarrassed that I'd hidden it for this long, it got harder and harder. She takes a deep breath. This is what I should have told you, the first day we met. I wasn't supposed to touch the baby. It was in the medical file. But when he went blue, I unwrapped him. I moved him around. I tapped his feet and turned him on his side. All the things you do when you're trying to get a baby responsive again. Then I heard footsteps and I wrapped him up tight again. I didn't want anyone seeing me do what I wasn't supposed to be doing. Why rewrite history, Ruth? I ask after a moment. The jury could hear that and think you tried your hardest. But they could also think you screwed up and did something that made him die. I want them to know that I did my job, she says. You keep telling me this doesn't have anything to do with the color of my skin, that it's about my competence. Well, in addition to everything else, I want them to know that I am a good nurse. I tried to save that baby. You have this idea that if you get on the stand, you'll be able to tell your story and be in control. And that's not how it works. Odette is going to shred you. She'll do everything she can to point out that this means you're a liar. Ruth looks at me. I'd rather they think I'm a liar than a murderer. If you get up there and give a different version than the one we've already presented, I explain carefully, you lose your credibility. I lose my credibility. I know what's best for you. There's a reason we're called counsel. You're supposed to listen to me. I'm tired of following orders. Last time I followed orders, I got into this mess. Ruth folds her arms. You are putting me on that stand tomorrow, she says flatly, or I'm going to tell the judge that you won't let me testify. And just like that, I know I'm going to lose this case. One night, when Ruth and I were preparing for the trial, we'd been working in my kitchen, and Violet had been high on life, running in circles around the house in her underwear and pretending to be a unicorn. Her shrieks punctuated our discussions, and then suddenly the sound wasn't joy, but pain. A moment later, Violet started sobbing, and we both ran to the living room, where Violet was lying on the floor, bleeding profusely from the temple. I felt my knees wobble, but before I could even reach for my daughter, Ruth had her cradled in her arms and had pressed the bottom of her shirt up to the wound. Hey now, she soothed. What happened? I slipped, Vi hiccuped as her blood soaked Ruth's shirt. And I see you've got a little cut here, Ruth said calmly. What I'm gonna take care of. She started ordering me around my own house, efficiently getting me to fetch a damp washcloth, antibiotic ointment, and a butterfly bandage from a first aid kit. She never let go of Violet, and she never stopped talking to her. Even when she suggested that we drive to Yale New Haven to see if maybe a stitch was in order, Ruth was steely, measured, while I continued to freak out, wondering if Violet would have a scar, if I would be flagged by CPS for not watching my kid more closely, or letting her run in socks on a slippery wooden floor. When Violet needed two stitches, it wasn't me she clung to, but Ruth, who promised her that if we sang really loud, she wouldn't feel anything. And so the three of us belted Let It Go at the top of our lungs. And Violet never cried. Later that night, when she had a clean bandage on her forehead and was asleep in her bed, I thanked Ruth. You're good at what you do, I told her. I know, she said. That's all she wants, to let people know she was treated unfairly because of her race, and for her reputation as a caregiver to remain intact, even if it means it will be tarnished by a guilty verdict. Drinking alone, Micah says when he comes home from the hospital and finds me in the dark, in the kitchen, with a bottle of Syrah. That's the first sign, you know. I lift up my glass and take a long swallow. Of what? Adulthood, probably, he admits. Hard day at the office. It started out great, legendary even, and then went to hell very quickly. Micah sits down next to me and loosens his tie. Do you want to talk about it, or should I get my own bottle? I push the Syrah toward him. I thought I had an acquittal in the bag. I sigh. And then Ruth went and decided to ruin it all. While he pours himself a glass of wine, I tell him everything. From the way Turk Bauer spouted his rhetoric of hate to the look in his eyes when he came after me. from the rush of adrenaline I got when my motion for judgment of acquittal was granted, to Ruth's admission about resuscitating the baby, to the dizzy realization that I had to put Ruth on the stand if she demanded it, even if it was going to tank my chances of winning my first murder case. "What am I supposed to do tomorrow?" I ask. No matter what I ask Ruth on the stand, she's going to be incriminating herself. And that doesn't even begin to consider what the prosecutor's going to do to her on cross. I shudder thinking about Odette, who doesn't even know that this boon is about to be granted. "I can't believe I was so close," I say softly. "I can't believe she's going to ruin it." Micah clears his throat. "Radical thought number one. Maybe you need to take yourself out of this equation." I've drunk enough that he's a little fuzzy at the edges, so maybe I've just misheard.
"I beg your pardon?"
"You weren't close. Ruth was." I snort. "That's semantics. We both win or we both lose. But she has more at stake than you do," Micah says gently. "Her reputation, her career, her life. This is the first trial that really matters to you, Kennedy. But it's the only one that matters to Ruth." I scrub a hand through my hair. "What's radical thought number two?" "What if the best thing for Ruth isn't winning this case?" Micah replies. "What if the reason this is so important to her isn't because of what she's going to say, but rather the fact that she is finally being given the chance to say it? Is it worth being able to say what you need to say if it means you land in prison? If it nets you a conviction? That goes against everything I've ever been taught, everything I've ever believed. But I'm not the one on trial." I press my fingers against my temples. Micah's words circle in my mind. He takes his glass and empties it into mine. "You need it more than I do," he says, and he kisses me on the forehead. "Don't stay up too late." On Friday morning, as I am hurrying to meet Ruth in the parking lot, I pass the memorial on the green near City Hall. It commemorates Singbei Pie, who was one of the slaves involved in the Amistad Mutiny. In 1839, a ship carried a group of Africans taken from their home to be slaves in the Caribbean. The Africans revolted, killed the captain and cook, and forced other sailors on board to head back toward Africa. The sailors, though, tricked the Africans and headed north where the ship was boarded by U.S. authorities. The Africans were imprisoned in a warehouse in New Haven, pending trial. The Africans revolted because a mulatto cook had heard that the white crew planned to kill the blacks and eat the meat themselves. The whites on board believed the Africans were cannibals. Neither side was right. When I reach the parking lot, Ruth won't even make eye contact with me. She starts walking quickly toward the courthouse, Edison by her side, until I grab her by the arm. "Are you still determined to do this? Did you think if I slept on it, I'd change my mind?" she asks. "I had hoped," I admit. "I'm begging you, Ruth." "Mama?" Edison looks at her face, and then mine, confused. I raise my brows as if to say, "Think of what you're doing to him." She slips her arm through her son's elbow. "Let's go," she replies, and she starts walking again. The crowds have swelled in front of the courthouse. Now that the media have reported that the prosecution's side of the case is finished, the taste for blood is getting stronger. I see Wallace Mercy and his crew from the corner of my eye, maintaining their vigil. Maybe I should have sicked Wallace on Ruth. Maybe he could have convinced her to duck her head and let justice be served in her favor. But then again, knowing Wallace, he would not turn down an opportunity to speak his mind. He'd probably have offered to coach Ruth in whatever it is she feels the need to say. Howard is pacing in front of the courtroom. "So," he says nervously, "are we resting, or?" "Yes," I say bluntly, "or." Just in case you wanted to know, the Bowers are back. They're in the gallery.
Thanks, Howard, I say with sarcasm. Now I feel even better. I speak to Ruth just once more, moments before we are asked to rise at the judge's arrival. I will give you just one piece of advice, I whisper. Be as cool and calm as possible. The minute you raise your voice, the prosecution is going to be all over you. And the way you answer me should be exactly the same way you respond when Odette's cross-examining you. She looks at me. It's quick how our eyes meet. But it's enough for me to see the flicker in them. The fear. I open my mouth, sensing the weakness, intending to reel her back in. But then I remember what Micah said. Good luck, I say. I rise and call Ruth Jefferson to the stand. She looks smaller in the box, somehow. Her hair is pulled back in a low bun, as usual. Have I noticed before how severe that looks? Her hands are folded in her lap, tightly. I know it's because she's trying to keep herself from shaking, but the jury doesn't. To them, it just looks like she's excessively formal. Prim. She repeats the oath quietly, without betraying any emotion. I know it's because she feels like she is on display. But shyness can be mistaken for haughtiness, and that could be a fatal flaw. Ruth, I begin, how old are you?
44, she says.
Where were you born?
Harlem, in New York City.
Did you go to school there?
Only for a couple of years. Then I transferred to Dalton on a scholarship.
Did you complete college? I ask.
Yes, I went to SUNY Plattsburgh as an undergrad, and then got my nursing degree at Yale.
Can you tell us how long that program was?
3 years.
When you graduate as a nurse, do you take an oath?
She nods. It's called the Florence Nightingale Pledge, Ruth says.
I enter a piece of paper into evidence and present it to her. Is this the pledge?
Yes.
Will you read it aloud?
Before God and those assembled here, I solemnly pledge to adhere to the code of ethics of the nursing profession, to cooperate faithfully with the other members of the nursing team, and to carry out faithfully and to the best of my ability the instructions of the physician or the nurse. She falters here. Who may be assigned to supervise my work.
Ruth takes a deep breath, forging ahead.
I will not do anything evil or malicious, and I will not knowingly give any harmful drug or assist in malpractice. I will not reveal any confidential information that may come to my knowledge in the course of my work, and I pledge myself to do all in my power to raise the standards and prestige of practical nursing. May my life be devoted to service and to the high ideals of the nursing profession.
She looks up at me. Is that oath fundamental to you as a nurse?
We take it very seriously, Ruth confirms. It's like the equivalent of the Hippocratic Oath for doctors.
How long have you been employed at Mercy West Haven Hospital?
Just over 20 years, Ruth says. My whole career.
What are your responsibilities?
I'm a neonatal nurse. I help deliver babies. I am in the OR during C-sections. I care for the mothers and then post-delivery for the newborns.
How many hours a week did you work?
40 plus, she replies. We often were asked to pull some overtime.
Ruth, are you married?
I'm a widow, she says. My husband was a soldier who died in Afghanistan. It happened about 10 years ago.
Do you have any children?
Yes, my son, Edison.
He's 17.
Her eyes shine, and she searches Edison out in the gallery.
Do you recall coming to work the morning of October 2nd, 2015?
Yes, Ruth says. I came in at 7 a.m. for a 12-hour shift.
Were you assigned to watch Davis Bower?
Yes. His mother had delivered early that morning. I was assigned to do typical postpartum care of Brittany Bauer and a nurse's newborn exam. She describes the exam.